Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
How you doing, internet? It is April 21st, 2017. You're listening to Waypoint Radio, and we are definitely not live from Lobby One. We are coming to you from all over the world, really. Well, all over the sort of general northeast and mid-northeast of the U.S. I'm Danielle Riendo, and I am joined by Patrick Klepek.
Hello, hello, hello. Is the Chicagoland area the mid-northeast?
I feel like it is. Because it's only, what, like 1,000 miles in? It's not like, okay, if America is like more than, it's like 3,500 across, and you're only 1,000, you're still like generally east, right? You're still, I don't know.
I'm spitting distance.
The, like, different Chicago teams are in different conferences in different sporting divisions. Like, it is an east and west city. That's just how it is.
You got both.
They're firmly in the Midwest.
Midwest.
But I'm in the northwest suburbs, so...
Oh.
Then you're basically a westerner, really.
You're a westerner. Is that what the
You should be wearing a cowboy hat, to be honest.
I have one.
Oh, good. Oh, well, I mean,
I wear it sometimes when I golf.
Perfect. Also joining us from the definite northeast, even further north and east from New York City where I am, is Rob Zachney.
We'd like to call it New England around here.
Yeah, is that right?
Yeah. We're a little choosy about our terms and what gets considered New England.
Oh, I know.
Oh.
I remember there was this very heated discussion about whether Rhode Island counts as New England as a lifelong Rhode Islander. I was very offended. Still offended. You know, my rat face is very offended. If you could see it right now, internet.
In my defense, I was getting pretty loopy that day because that was the day that the allergies finally caught up with me. And, like, that was the onset.
Yeah. Well, Team Waypoint got hit with some nasty flu.
It's been bad. My kid got me sick, but then there was a flu going around in the offices, and it's bad. It has been a down week for the health of Waypoint.
Yeah. Well, it's also something of a down week, down month, I don't know, a little bit down in general. Patrick, you wrote a really great piece, it went up just today, about Guardians of the Galaxy, the Telltale series, and about how Telltale has been kind of riding on the same technology for a long-ass time at this point, and it's starting to really kind of catch up with them.
Yeah, like, to your first point, it is nice that video games are pumping the brakes a little bit. Like, it is nice, you know. As amazing as the first couple of months of this year were and continue to be, given how many games I didn't get back to, I still haven't finished Yakuza 0. I had barely touched Nioh. Like, I'm, 15 hours into Persona 5, but I played that for a week. Then I put it on pause so I could try and play some other smaller games before I go back to Persona 5. So it's been nice to actually, it's okay. Like, there's so many video games that came out in the first 4 months. I would probably be fine for the rest of the year with what's already been given. But, I have been trying to check out some other things. And I've talked about this on the show before, that my wife, who, supporter of video games, helped us buy a house, those video games. But doesn't spend a lot of her free time playing them herself. But one of the few things we do is that we play pretty much all of the series that Telltale puts out. We started playing them with The Walking Dead because, at least at that time, I was a fan of the show. And playing a video game version of that seemed interesting. And they did some really fascinating stuff with the storytelling in the first season of The Walking Dead. And since then, because it was something for us to sit down and enjoy together, you know, I hold the controller, she makes the decisions in the game. It was just kind of a fun way to bond over this medium that has brought, you know, me a lot of joy and success in my career, and something that we can enjoy together. We've often treated Telltale kind of like a TV channel. It's like more like, hey, yeah, what's on? You know, what is Telltale doing right now? And we don't necessarily finish all the series to completion. Like, the Game of Thrones series was not great. I think we played two episodes in and just sort of dropped it. Never got around to the Borderlands series just because I bounced off, like, the stylings of Borderlands. Although I've heard that the Borderlands series is really good, partially because it was designed by people who don't have a particular affinity for Borderlands, so they tried to create stories in a world that was interesting to people that may not necessarily have gotten into the comedic trappings of the Gearbox game. So anyway, it's a long way to say that I pay pretty close attention to these games. I've played a lot of them. I'm aware of their tics. And the thing that just kind of came to a head with this most recent series, The Guardians of the Galaxy, which the first episode is out, is just how their technology is now undercutting their main selling point, which is story and characters. I can deal with crummy frame rates. I can deal with some stilted animations. But Telltale's gambit was that, you know, we're making adventure games. But, like, what used to mean adventure game was storytelling with puzzles. Like, there was sort of a template there. Like, you know, Thimbleweed Park, which just came out from Ron Gilbert, is very much another game in that model. Broken Age was a game in that model. And what Telltale did was take the story part and slowly start to sort of massage and eventually erase out anything but the storytelling part. And, you know, you make decisions, but those decisions are very light. You know, the story is still edited, you know, A and Z, like, you still get there, you just kind of deviate a little bit along the way. The story still ends largely in the place that the storytellers wanted you to, and I'm fine with all that. But in Guardian specifically, the contrast against James Gunn's cinematic Guardians of the Galaxy, which is like razor sharp editing and wit and humor, and like there's a lot of moving parts that work in concert to make that movie work, and they ape a lot of that stylings for the game, but then it is undercut by the fact that it seems like when you're watching the characters, they appear to look like they're out of a discarded Chuck E. Cheese restaurant. Like, they just kind of move their arms up robotically. The mouth is clearly not at all synced to what they're saying. It just kind of flaps open and shut. And timing, which is huge to comedy and thus very critical to the Guardian series in particular. Like, there are moments where they set up a joke and then, like, it has trouble loading the next scene, or there's enough of a pause that it ruins the punchline. And so it's you look at the writing and you go, this is funny. This is a funny joke. You look at the voice acting. They nailed that part. But the actual technology, the engine, like, works against this series in particular, but has been in a larger problem for Telltale's games. I just think it was illustrated very acutely in this one. And it allowed me to sort of tell this story that I had heard a long time ago, Telltale's engine famously internally is derided even by the folks that work on it, because it is just not evolved and in the way that they would have liked alongside the company expanding and creating as many series as they are. And so the anecdote I use is that since The Walking Dead, around the time that Telltale kind of became sort of a blockbuster studio, at least in terms of the kinds of games they make, it didn't have a physics engine. And now it still doesn't have a physics engine. Now, granted, like, in an adventure game, there's largely cutscene-based. For the types of games they make, physics isn't the most important thing, but it's indicative of, like, a larger internal problem with the tool that they have to use, is that you just don't have a lot of tools that you can use. It limits experimentation. And this is largely because Telltale continues to use a proprietary engine. They don't use Unity. They don't use UE4, which is fine. Lots of studios use internal proprietary engines. There's nothing wrong with that. But there has been this long simmering tension over a tool set that is extremely limiting. And I think we are seeing that manifest in the kind of formulaic storytelling and design that you end up seeing in these games that may be also hampered by their production schedule. But all this, like, kind of comes together to undercut, if you're a studio that is selling story and characters, if things are working against you emphasizing that, that is a problem for your studio that has become more acute over time.
So, Patrick, Is this a fairly talky episode? Because I know a lot of like Telltale first episodes are a little bit like stage setting and don't get into too much action. I'm curious, like, does this one follow that mold? Is it largely like dialogue where you're seeing these issues?
Yeah, especially because like Guardians, like as a premise, like yes, the action is whatever, it's interesting, but like, you know, the reason, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy, at least James Gunn's interpretation of it in the Marvel movies, like, is about these characters and the interactions these characters have. So that's what at least the first episode is very much about. There are sort of the, you know, like brief action set pieces and exploratory stuff, but it is really a lot of talking with people. And so, like, there's a scene I highlight, which is, you know, between Drax and Gamora and Star-Lord, in which they're having, you know, kind of reminiscing on a battle they had with Thanos, and they're sort of, like, cheering to the fallen. And it's, like, it's a comedic and also dramatic scene that is, like, deeply undercut by, like, the fact that these characters can't emote in a way that allows you to sort of get into the scene in the way that the writing and voice acting is trying to get you to do. So it's, like, especially in this, the Guardians one, which is very character-based, as opposed to the last series they did, the Batman series, which I also generally liked. That one was, like, more action. Like, there was character stuff. There's a lot happening with Bruce Wayne, but there was more of a balance. And at least in this one, like, this is all about the characters and them interacting and speaking with each other. And so it's really frustrating to, you know, this is kind of thing that even my wife can notice. It's like, she's not next, you know, she doesn't play a ton of games, but if she can tell that, like, the animation is, like, kind of janky in this, like, it says something that even she can pick up on that.
Yeah, so, I did play Batman, and for me, like, the dialogue was a little off, but I actually found that easier to live with because it's, like, maybe it's because I played enough, like, 90s FMV adventures growing up, where it was, like, you know, like, somebody would say something, and then, like, everything would be frozen for, like, 3 seconds,
yeah.
The CD-ROM would be like, meh. Like, Tex Murphy games were all about, like, snappy comedic timing that had to wait on your CD-ROM, like, every single time. But Batman, so I played it on the PlayStation 4 earlier this year, because it went on sale, and I was like, I like Batman, I like Telltale,
yeah.
I'm sure this is going to be awesome. Like, it's a Telltale game that I found, like, borderline unplayable in the fourth and fifth episodes because it started getting a little more action-heavy, which was, A, less compelling. If you're going to play an action-heavy Batman game, like, boy, is there a million of them that you'd rather play before Telltale take on that.
Right.
But the other issue was that, so there's this scene in, I want to say it's the next-to-last episode of Batman, pretty dramatic stuff. The police commissioner of Gotham City, not James Gordon, but like his predecessor, is like
right.
out at a cafe with his wife or something, and whatever the crazy group of Arkham-affiliated terrorists.
I've forgotten what they are, too.
Yep.
We'll just say that we're trying not to spoil it and not that we've completely forgotten the story.
Yeah, absolutely. I was like, the Sons of Arkham?
Oh, you're close.
The Sons of
Anarchy?
Something. The Children of Arkham.
Children of the Arkham.
So
no, it is the Children of Arkham. That is correct.
Children of Arkham. So they show up, and so does Batman. Like, Batman's trying to save all these people from these terrorists, and the police commissioner's there, who has been sort of an adversary to this point. There's a whole, like, almost Untouchables baby carriage down the steps, slow motion,
wow.
Like, sequence of events where a lot of things are happening. And meanwhile, Batman needs to be kicking ass throughout this entire scene. And the entire thing on PlayStation 4 just fell completely, completely apart. Like, things got badly out of sync, where you now hear dialogue cues from, like, two screens back while playing something entirely different on the screen. So, like, Batman is, like, punching a dude, and you're hearing, like, the police commissioner's last words, like, while he's doing it. Like, you have to save Gotham, Batman. And, like, Batman's just going ham on this dude, and then, like, he turns around and, like, cradles the dying police commissioner. And now dead silence. So actually, it got out of sequence where, like, it was serving up the animations so late that the sound just, like, went off and did its own thing. Plus, because Telltale only has one gameplay trick, which is, like, the timing puzzle, the timing game of their Simon Says Action, this stuff actually needs to be pretty precise. And
it's all you've got. You have briefly exploring a room until you trigger an item that triggers the next conversation. You have, like, mostly meaningless choices as they've gotten away from, like, actual, like, Walking Dead style, like, you know, Walking Dead is different because it's zombies and it's life and death, so the stakes there are clearly different. But, like, the choices haven't really meant that much in a long time. So it's like, the one other thing they've got are these, like, timing action sequences. And, yeah, if they can't nail that because, like, of performance issues, like, you know, you've essentially undercut, like, one-third of your gameplay options.
It feels like these honestly would be better off as radio plays at this point. As, like, a ridiculously well-produced, you know, with voice acting, like, radio drama. Like, back in the 40s, but it's Batman, or it's, you know, it's the Guardians of the Galaxy, which is, I don't know what that says, you know? I mean, it's very, I know the folks who work there are very frustrated, but there was something else in your piece, Patrick, that you sort of mentioned, like, you know, a few years ago, it was a lot easier to kind of be like, oh, you know, maybe if something's a little choppy, that's fine. The writing is so good and the characters are so good. But also, Telltale was not the, like, Batman, Game of Thrones, Guardians of the Galaxy, like, major, major license, you know, sort of bigger budget, lots of people working there kind of studio that it was 4 or 5 years ago. They were making smaller games 4 or 5 years ago because there were smaller studios. So now it feels like it's a little bit harder to excuse some of the technical issues when it's like, y'all are rolling in money at this point. Maybe not literally rolling in money. You know, they might not be
that
successful.
They're not a scrappy upstart, right? Like,
exactly.
I think a lot of this was forgiven in the first season of The Walking Dead because it was so compelling and interesting, and they were clearly taking a lot of narrative and creative risks that, okay, my saves didn't go over. Okay, I'll rush through the episode again. I was fortunate. I've never really run into these, like, really significant save problems that I know lots and lots of people have had issues with. Like, there was someone on Twitter today telling me about what was it? I don't know which series they were playing. It might have been Game of Thrones, but they made some monumental decision in episode 4, and the game ignored that decision in episode 5.
Oh,
like,
no.
It either registered the wrong save or who knows what happened. But essentially, he started episode 5 with everyone being upset at him for a choice he didn't make. And
Wow. There's
no way to go back and just, like, tick a box and change that. And that's incredibly frustrating because the investment, what they're selling is you know, having an active participation in this story. And then so the technical problems, the save game issues, like all these technical hurdles that were not necessarily excusable years ago, but at least were understandable and was like a hoop you were willing to jump through. Like, just isn't, you know, they have hundreds of employees. They had a significant investment, externally from Lionsgate. Like, I don't know exactly their on-hand cast situation, but for the amount of games they're putting out at the pace they're putting them out, they're doing all right, and it's not excusable. It hasn't been excusable for a long time, and it's frustrating as someone that is a fan of these games that looks at a game like Until Dawn, looks at a game like Life is Strange, and sees what is possible from expanding the adventure. I think Life is Strange is probably the best example of, like, what is possible when you, like, Life is Strange is enhanced by its, you know, better modeling and animation and all that stuff. Like, that the story would if you were to take that story and put it into Telltale's technology, it wouldn't have been as effective. Like, Until Dawn, part of the reason that game works is because it has the really advanced, like, a facial capture, which is, like, slightly creepy but also interesting in an L.A. noir sort of way.
Yeah.
But it shows what's possible. And it's not that because of sort of the pace that Telltale works at, I don't necessarily expect them to be able to pull that off. But I feel like there is something in between that would greatly benefit the storytelling they're trying to do. Because, like, as I point out in the piece, I think Guardians is really well written and, like, surprisingly adept at sort of maintaining James Gunn's stylization from the film in a way that I found myself laughing, but I should have been laughing more when, like, you know, a punchline is set up between, like, Star-Lord and Drax, but there's, like, the halting pause that Rob was talking about that, like, the dead air isn't, you know, that's not there on purpose. That's there because it's jankily trying to load the next scene, and by then you sort of lost, like, what they've set up. So, you know, I'm going to keep playing these games because they're a certain comfort food for me. And as I mentioned in the piece, that's both, like, a compliment and a problem. Like, I think after The Walking Dead's first season, I think the sky was the limit for Telltale in terms of, like, creative risks they could have taken. And I think some series have shown them to try. I think The Wolf Among Us, which was not perfect by any stretch, had a lot of problems, but I think showed an attempt at like a more mature, interesting sort of subject matter that they could play with, that I thought was the right track. And it's like, that's like, you know, the one series that hasn't gotten a second season. And I want these games to be better. It's like I write this story from like a place where I deeply love a lot of what they're doing, and I see ways that they can improve it, and I look as my job is to kind of vocalize something that I've seen from a lot of Telltale fans, that just like, oh man, we love what you're doing, Telltale, but just like, come on,
put a little in there, put a little bit of quality of life improvements would go a long, long way.
It seems right,
like. And. Yeah. It just seems to be getting worse. Like, I don't remember The Walking Dead operating that way. And maybe that's because, like, they stayed within what they could actually achieve with that engine a little more effectively. But I remember that experience being reasonably crisp. And now, like, Batman was basically unplayable by the end. It sounds like this is, increasingly bad. So I don't know if it's their... Is the technology's getting creaky, or they're no longer putting the time in that's required to circumvent its creakiness?
Yeah, it's hard to tell. You know, they're certainly publishing a lot more platforms than they were in the past two, sure. Which that doesn't help. I mean, they you know, impressively launch on basically everything when they launch a new series, you know, PC, Mac, you know, PS4, Xbox One, you know, they're on iOS and Android devices. Like, yeah. I mean, when you're doing all of that, you're going to increase the possibility of issues. And by developing something that can adapt to that many platforms, you introduce the possibility of more of issues. So, you know, it's tough for me. You know, I've heard stories internally, but, you know, I can't paint a complete picture of what that is. And my story doesn't try to necessarily prescribe a solution, because I don't know what their process is, like what it is like for a production of an episode. It's more just, you know, I like these games. Please do better, because I think I could like your games more.
Sure. And they are, you know, to your very original point, they are the perfect companion video gaming experience. I do the same thing with my girlfriend. Like, one of us will be playing, one of us will make the decision. Sometimes we'll, like, chat about, like, oh, man, what should we do? And, you know... That's actually really fun. It's like a really fun collaborative.
It's even better now because they a couple of games ago, I'm not sure where it came in. I know it's in like the last year and a half or so. They added this crowd play feature, which they often demonstrate when they're doing like theater presentations of their games at festivals, so like hundreds of people can weigh in on a decision. But for me, like what it means is now, like whereas my wife would communicate the decision and then I would input it on the controller, now she just literally inputs the decision through her phone, and like it's cool. Like it's like one step closer to her and I sort of like bonding over the game. So it's like that stuff is cool, but that's like the stuff surrounding the game as opposed to the stuff that is, you know, a little more inside.
On the inside. Different game. So, Rob, I want to ask you something about sort of what you've been playing, but even better, a question came in that was such a Rob question. Mm-hmm. So I think we'll take an early dip into the question bucket, and we'll make it like your thing that you're talking about too. See, this is me. I'm not Austin. I gotta cut corners. You know, I'm not as good a host, but I'm trying to make it work. So, Rob, this one came in from Oscar, and Oscar writes, I'm currently fighting with myself to stay away from Europa Universalis 4 so I can go back to playing Witcher 3 and Bayonetta, or try that new Stellaris expansion. But what if I restarted my Austria run and was more proactive about preventing French and Ottoman expansions? 150 hours go by in which I've played and finished like 8 other games or made some minor progress in The Witcher 3, and I resent all that time that feels unproductive in retrospect. I might have a problem. A problem is in caps. Do you have games like this where you feel like you'd rather be playing something else and yet you just keep coming back for reasons you can't explain? Obviously, this is a question for everybody, but like it was framed around you, Rob. We had Witcher in there, we had Stellaris, we had Universa, whatever that name is. Like, I always fuck it up.
Europa Universalis. It's natural to feel that way because you only play full lifetime commitment video games, Oscar. That's
my friend.
I mean, that is And that's me too. Like, I've got a Witcher 3 save that I'm keen to return to. I think the last time it was fired up was sometime in mid 2016. I need to catch up on that. The problem is those are all games that I think reward that extra time. So I think more, there are absolutely those games you end up sort of resenting because you know that you could take a little break and play a quick 10-hour shooter campaign or you know something like that. But there is no way around this. Like it's the opportunity cost. Like if you're gonna be serious about Europa Universalis, that's going to take the place. That's going to represent probably like 8 or 9 other games that you could have played that you didn't, and that's just the deal you made. I don't really like, you know, I think probably Dark Souls is a similar sort of game.
Yeah,
like I'm certainly feeling that like with Persona, like I said, like I played 15 hours of it 1 week and was like, okay, this game is a 80-hour commitment minimum. if I was to just keep charging through that, I could probably finish this game in a month, but then it would mean I have played one game for a month, which is fine for a lot of people, but both incompatible with my job, and then I also just like playing a variety of things. And so it's like, okay, so I played it for a week, and then like, okay, I'll play Guardians, then I'll play Little Nightmares, and I'll play these little things that like give me some variety, and then come back to Persona. But that's difficult sometimes with games that require like sort of a commitment, like with all of your mental energy, where like taking a break is going to make it difficult to come back to it. Dark Souls games are kind of like that, where when I come back for the DLC, it requires a ramp up time where I just like get accustomed to the flow of playing that game, because it's not necessary. It is like riding a bike, but you've got to ride that bike around the block a few times or get killed by a monster 10 times before you
figure it monsters. Out. Yeah, for sure. I'm having this right now really, really, really badly with Zelda. I can't put it down. I'm like 120 hours into this game, and I still haven't even finished much of the main story quest. There's still a divine beast out there stomping around in my game.
Which one?
The camel.
The one in the desert?
Yeah, in the desert. But I've got all the great fairies now, and I'm upgrading all my clothes to like the complete degree, and I'm finding every single little secret. I'm finding every little landscape feature that has a name. That's my new thing, is like every single, this mountain or this swamp or whatever. And it's starting to really get in the way. It was getting in the way a few weeks ago. Now it's really an issue. Like I'm going to say
that. Yeah, game came out in the middle of March or the beginning of March.
March 3rd, I think. It was a 3-3, and I had it maybe a day before. I've been playing the Wii U version. That's what came in early. That Austin didn't take. You know, I have no hard feelings or anything.
Thanks for the shit version of the game, Austin.
I mean, it's.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
It's fine. It plays beautifully. But I'm playing Full Throttle, also contributing to the adventure game discussion. And that game, the Full Throttle Remaster, is beautiful and amazing. And it's maybe one of the best games of that era. I think it's kind of between that and Manny. What the other?
Grim Fandango.
Yes, Grim Fandango. I honestly feel like those two are maybe my favorite actual 90s adventure game. And playing this again. Well, I didn't play the whole thing previously. I wasn't actually a PC kid. I had been exposed to Full Throttle sort of later on and, at friends' houses and that sort of thing. But I love the atmosphere of that game. I love the sort of simplified interface of that game. There's like, talk or hit or grab things. Like the verbs are somewhat
the
simplified.
The only things that Danielle needs to know. Talk, hit, grab.
That's right.
Only verbs that Danielle Rando has in her life and in her video games.
Correct. You know me. You know how it is. So and it's awesome. And it has all this sort of like precursor, Brutal Legend and Psychonaut stuff in it, which those are like my favorite games ever. So I'm all excited about it. And I'm loving it. But I can't play more than like 20 minutes without being like, Wonder what Link's doing right now. Yeah, you know, I bet there's some good mushrooms in that forest that I saved in a few minutes ago. And it's like, this is getting to be like an addiction. This is actually getting to be a little bit of, as Oscar says, a problem, you know, capital letters. Like, I think I might need to finish Zelda just so I can be like, no, you're done. You did it. It's done.
Is that you keep sort of setting like new things you want to do in the game?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. See, I think that's the real danger too. Is like a lot of those Paradox games, for instance, that Oscar listed. Like, it's not like Civ, where Civ builds toward the set ending and like which victory you're going for, and then the game ends, and then it releases you from this hell.
Right.
Like EU is a game where you're constantly like, okay, it's really open ended. So I guess the next thing I want to do is have my guy become Pope, and then use that to excommunicate the French king so I can annex the Dutch. Cool, I think I'll do that. And that, you just committed to like a 20-hour plot, and you're going to go do that. And it's going to be a lot of fun. Like, if you pull that off, that's going to be sweet, but it's going to create problems for you.
Yep. Well, and it's funny because there was a piece that Austin wrote earlier this week about how games have a lot of endings but so few conclusions, I think was and his sort of like general premise was that, you know, critiquing a game like Breath of the Wild, which is indicative of the way a lot of games, and especially these open world games in which there are so many things you could continue doing, is that he wishes more games allowed you to see the after effects of saving the world or whatever is the big goal. And a lot of games just end, or when you finish them, then they dump you at, you know, the moments before the final battle, so you can kind of go back out into the world. And I have found, sort of like emotionally and psychologically, because if Zelda had allowed me to go back out into the world and see a little bit of what had happened after, I might have stuck with it and kept playing with it and dinking around with it a little bit more. But because I sort of finished it and kind of put a cap on it, and then the game's response to that is like, well, let's go back to that moment before you beat Ganon and keep looking around. Like, it kind of undercuts my desire to wanna go explore that world again, because it's like, well, I went and did the thing. And so what, now I'm gonna go do the other stuff and then come back and do the thing again, I guess, like, as opposed to beating Ganon and then having an opportunity to, even if I don't actually find out what happened, just say like, you did it, buddy, and like go out into the world. Like, it feels like anticlimactic in a way that undercut my desire to want to continue poking in the world, because I felt a sense of closure, and if the game could have more effectively put me back into that world and enticed me into continuing poking a product, and I'll go back there because I know better and there are side quests I still want to see. I thought it was a bummer the way that game ends, because specifically of that, where it's like there is 100 hours more of things I could do in that game, and it would have been nice to have sort of like an easier transition into actually doing that.
Yeah, that's why I haven't I've heard that.
Yeah,
like,
you seem like you're avoiding it, because once you beat Ganon, you're like, oh, okay, well, I did the thing.
Yeah, the thing is done. I could get those mushrooms, but who cares? Totally. God, that's what's making me think, like, just for my own sanity, that maybe I should, all right, I'll get the damn mushroom, and then maybe three other things, and then go for the final divine beast, and then go get Ganon. We'll see. If it's July and I'm still doing this, maybe
we'll take it away from you.
Yeah, somebody might need to take the
Wii U
away.
Well, no, but at that point, they'll probably be announcing the, you know, the expansion that's coming out later this year. So we're going to have to just unplug, just hide the power cord from you at some
pretty
point.
Pretty much. It was a little dangerous, for sure.
You were also playing the Disney package that came out earlier this week, right?
It's really good. That successfully drew me away from Zelda for like four
or
5 hours.
Yeah, totally.
2 hours. Exactly. I mean, a day.
I feel so bad for Full Throttle right now, because Disney Adventure came out. I got the code a few days ago when I was in like a slight waning period with Zelda, like still playing it, no question, but like playing it for an hour kind of thing. And then I spent the weekend, I found the last fairy, and now I'm like full into the fever again. But yeah, Disney Afternoons, the Disney Afternoon Collection is wonderful and great. It's five games from the 90s, or late 80s, early 90s, NES games that were those really, really good Capcom Disney games. And they were all sort of based on the Disney Afternoon block. I don't know if we're all the same age, I think, or around the same age-ish. So, you know,
it was all about that tailspin. All about that tailspin.
Tailspin, DuckTales, Chippendales Rescue Rangers, Darkwing Duck. Those are the games in this collection. It's DuckTales 1 and 2, Chippendales 1 and 2, Tailspin, and the Darkwing Duck game. They're all really good, and they hold up really well. I mean, DuckTales especially probably is the one that I played the most of as a little kid, and then just on muscle memory was able to just get through and find every secret again. And I haven't picked up that game since, like, 1990. Like, it's been a long time.
I somehow never played any of those games. That, like, I don't know why that was a weird blind spot. Maybe my local family video store did not stock those games for some reason, but I don't know. For some reason, even though I watched those shows and owned a NES, for some reason I didn't really play a lot of the Capcom Disney games.
I missed out on a couple of them. I had never played the Tailspin game. I think I had only played like the Darkwing Duck game at a friend's house once or something. The DuckTales games I played a ton of and loved and had very fond memories of, but. Yeah, I mean, going back, you know, it's always a little weird. You're always going to be like, okay, here we go. But they're actually beautiful and sound amazing, and they're really well-constructed platformers. Like, they were from the era where everything had a platformer. Like, every cartoon mascot, everybody who was on a cereal box, everybody on a pizza box. Like, Yo Noid was a game for the Domino's.
It was, pizza, yes.
Dude.
I somehow played that game, yeah, but not Tailspin.
But not the, like, really great. These are
probably because,
like,
I loved Domino's.
You know, it was there. I mean, that game wasn't bad or anything. It was just sort of one of those middling, you know,
yeah,
mascot platformer games. For some reason, I think Capcom put a lot of their sort of, like Bomberman, but much lighter. Like, these games are not nearly as difficult. Darkwing Duck is a little tougher than the others, but generally they're fairly accessible kind of versions of that. You know, they're all platformers where, at least the DuckTales games, you can kind of choose the world you're going into. You can go in at different orders. You get sort of items as you go, you know, that kind of thing. But it's all, like, very colorful and very, like, child-friendly, which I'm happy about now. Playing these games, being like, oh, okay, this isn't killing me. This isn't too difficult, basically.
An adult with your childlike reflexes.
Basically, with my sloppy, you know, I'm just trying to play.
The game has some sort of unique rewind function, right?
Yeah, that was sort of my favorite part.
Can you explain that, like, how that works?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just like in a Forza or, you know, racing game. If you screw up, you can just hold the trigger as long as you like, and the screen literally just rewinds, you know, with sound effects and music included. So basically, in like, if you're in a tough boss fight, or if you're, you know, you keep falling at a place or something, you just immediately hit the button, go back to where you're at a safe spot, and keep playing. It is a godsend for the games that you don't have muscle memory for, you know, knowing every secret or every sort of cheap area or that sort of thing, and it makes them really, really enjoyable.
Is there any sort of, like, limitations on that, or is it just at your discretion, sort of like an unlimited to continue cheat? Like, just, hey, man.
Yeah. Unlimited quarters, basically, is what it is, which I think is great. I'm sure there are some purists who are like, oh, you've ruined it because you're allowing me to cheat, but it's kind of like,
there's no reason nobody makes games like that anymore.
Yeah, like, honestly, yeah, well,
what's in front of you is like, well, either you just won't finish the game because you don't have the tolerance for a game like this or the time for a game like this anymore, or you essentially do the equivalent of having save states in an emulator and, like, actually get a chance to see what the game has to offer and get to the end credits. Like, you can still play the game without it. It's fine.
Yeah, you don't have to use it. I really am in favor of this sort of thing for, especially for an older game. You know, these games were made with a very different conception of what difficulty was fair in the, you know, almost 30 years ago, some of them. So I'm totally cool with it. I know I'm sure there's, like, a speedrunner somewhere who's pissed off that it exists, but you know, that's fine. Go with God, speedrunner.
Yeah, I think that's really smart. And it sounds like also that this game, which is developed by the same folks that worked on the last Mega Man collection with Capcom.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's,
you know,
right.
Folks like Frank Cifaldi, who's, you know, doing historian and archivist work in video games. I should look up his Patreon if you wanted to support it, because that would be the right thing to do for this as I talk.
Yeah, that's
slowly.
Okay. And another interesting thing as you're finding it, is that it sort of came out on the same day as Full Throttle and another sort of remake. There was a really funny thing where...
Oh, yeah, the Monster Boy.
Remake. Monster Boy and Wonder World.
Mike Diver is super upset right now that we don't know the name of his... Mega Drive platformer that was popular in Europe. You're right. Like there was four different games that came out that handled how to deal with nostalgia and modernizing a game in very different ways. Like, you know, the Disney Afternoon Collection is purist, but with some alterations that maybe make it easier to play. Whereas the Monster Boy and Wonder World was the same game, but they put a new aesthetic over it, and you can swap between it to see that like the game is literally one-to-one. And yes, the Video Game History Foundation, which you can find at patreon.com/gamehistory.org if you want to help him. He's doing a ton of great work trying to archive video game history in a way that video game creators and developers and publishers do a very poor job of. So it's really fantastic work that he's out there doing. And he partnered the studio he works at worked with Capcom on the Mega Man collection and then also on the Disney Afternoon collection. So like there's his like side work that he's doing in which he's scanning magazines and, you know, dumping ROMs and things like that, but then also, you know, working with publishers to like essentially create better collections, you know, collections that actually give a sense of history. I know that Danielle, you're a big fan of the Rare games, and it seems like Rare and Microsoft did a very good job of that with the collection they put out a little while ago. Yeah,
that was pretty amazing. And like, holy shit, they made a lot of really good games for a period there, for sure. One other quick thing on the note of sort of history and archiving this history. This was maybe one of the only compilations where I got really excited about the sort of extras. It's not a massive amount of extras, but it's a lot of sort of concept art and showing how the artists drew these sprites. These are very, very beautiful sprites. This is generally pretty late NES era, so folks really kind of knew what they were doing art-wise and animation-wise. And sort of going from this really, really beautifully animated cartoons to a really beautifully animated 8-bit game that did, you know, justice to these cartoons. I love sprite art. I love good pixel art, you know, not just for nostalgia's sake, but I really like a good, beautiful, clean kind of pixel art piece, I guess. Piece, whatever. Games, media, whatever. Yeah, you're going to call it. And it's really cool to actually take a look at that. So it was one of the few like compilations where I actually dug into all that stuff and was like, oh, this is how they drew this robot dog from Rescue Rangers, you know, things like that. it's fun for me to take a look at. So yeah, really, really nicely done compilation. And the only thing that's missing on there is the Little Mermaid game for the NES. It is also shockingly good and holds up better than you might think. But that wasn't in the Disney Afternoon block. I don't think that was ever a cartoon. But one day, I would love for that to be accessible and able to be played.
Is that also a Capcom game?
It is, yeah.
Wow, geez.
They did an amazing job on those games. It's pretty incredible.
So I played a lot of the SNES ones, like the Mickey, Aladdin, the Mickey Mouse. And, the Land and like specifically the Mickey Mouse platformers that that Capcom worked on.
Castle of Illusion and things like that. Yeah. Those were great too. Those were awesome. So Capcom did some pretty amazing work with the Disney properties back in the day. It's kind of crazy. I mean, I feel like we kind of look on that and say like, oh, you know, licensed works can be very hit or miss, that sort of thing. But it was a very, very good era for them for that.
I mean, they were definitely the exception to the rule. Like, that's the thing. Like, literally everything got Yo-Noid a video was game more, tie-in. And, you know,
Don't talk shit about Yo-Noid.
You know, it's not a bad game. It's not a bad game.
It might be, but don't talk shit about it anyway.
I feel like I went back to it way later on and was like, okay, you know, this isn't bad. We'll see. Maybe next 72, maybe we'll play something
we will
like
beat
that.
Yo-Noid.
Yeah, you know real,
we're gonna play
Knack.
That little 7-Up dude got his own video game too.
That game was actually kind of good.
I remember it being kind of good, but I also remember kind of being like, I am playing a game around a really like 6th-rate marketing mascot.
Oh yeah,
he's a red circle.
Cool
with legs.
Spot. I think it was called Cool Spot, wasn't it?
God, I don't know.
And that was like later on, and not to go off on a huge tangent here, but that was like a little bit later on. That was a PlayStation 1 game, and I think it was like mid to late 90s, actually. So it was already like the 6th rate, you know, marketing campaign.
I think I played it on SNES. So if it was really? Also on PlayStation 1, it must have been like a squarely in the middle.
96, yeah. 95, like one of the... I'm trying to... Maybe I played the sequel. There was a Pepsi Man game. Like, it's... There's a lot. There sure is.
They were just ahead of their time. They didn't anticipate people would want to engage with brands as much as they do right now.
I mean, you're not wrong. Like, you're not even a little bit wrong. Let's do one more quick question from the bucket and call it a day. This is a lighter, easier one, I think, a little bit. And this one comes from... Colton F. writes, "How's it going, Waypointer crew? I was wondering what everyone's favorite small details are that they look for in games. For me, I always appreciate good reload animations in shooters. Beyond a reload animation just looking cool, I admire when the animations fit the theme of the game, like in Crysis 2. Every weapon had 3 different reload animations based on whether you're normal, armored, or stealth mode. Normal having standard shooter reloads, armored having exaggerated and slammy reloads, and stealth having really careful, quiet reloads." And he, or they link to the Crysis 2 reload animation video.
Which is really cool, by the way. Like,
yeah, that's rad.
He's like loading this like futuristic revolver 3 different ways, and it's actually really cool. And yeah. I could totally see that adding a lot to that sense of like, especially when you're in stealth, right? Where you're like, dude's quietly like sort of thumbing cartridges into the revolver. Like, that's awesome. Like, 100% on board with
that's
that.
Really good.
A small detail that I noticed recently while playing Persona 5 is I appreciate efficiencies in interfaces that allow you to accomplish things faster. Like, the game can assume what you want to do and allows you to do it faster rather than navigating your way there. So, for example, part of the way that Persona 5 combat works is predicated on experimenting with different elements, you know, fire and thunder and things like that, to see what the weakness is for an enemy. And so once you've discovered the weakness for an enemy, you're probably going to want to use that again on the enemy because it weakens them and blah, it does more damage, blah, 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 blah. And so once that happens, you can just hit R1 and the game will navigate immediately through the menu, pull up the weakness. And this is even if it's not even on a per battle basis. Once you've discovered the weakness for an enemy, the next time you encounter them, all you have to do is hit R1 and the game will immediately jump to that weakness. And then all you have to do is hit X to cast it. Like, it just saves an incredible amount of time, mental energy. You don't have to, you know, probably over the course of playing a 100-hour game, I'm guessing that saves you hours of time having to dig through that menu. The game also has another smart feature, which is often if you're fighting off against some weaker enemies where you're just going to sit there and hit X and like just do the normal attack, blah, 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 blah. It has something called a rush mode. So you hit option on the controller and it just immediately does physical attacks constantly. And it skips animations. It just goes doot, 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 doot.
Nice.
But it goes slow enough that if for some reason things go wrong or a status effect messes up your the flow of the battle, you can stop it and then, you know, kind of intervene and choose a different path for your characters. But just both those things together make the flow of combat, which can often feel or sometimes feel tedious in a JRPG. It's built into sort of the design of a lot of those, and especially Persona 5. But it tries to meet you halfway and say, okay, well, even though you're going to be doing this a lot, here are ways that it's going to be more efficient. Here's the way it's going to be easier to get through. And like, I really appreciate those tiny details because it also shows a amount of care and attention to detail inside of the developers that they're respecting your time. Like, there's a huge part of what I look for in games these days, especially as a parent with less time, is a game being mindful of the time that I'm spending with it. And details like that show me that, yes, this game is crazy long, but the developers are mindful of the time I'm spending and putting into it and trying to maximize the time that I'm spending with it.
Yeah, that sounds very, very helpful. Rob, what about you? What's something you've been noticing?
So many good details. So many delicious little treats. To stay with the firearm theme,
yeah.
I always really enjoyed the guns in the Red Orchestra games. Nice reload animations, but also they're just One thing that Red Orchestra is very good about is the guns interact very contextually with the environment. So a perfect example is, you see more of it now, but like when you're crouched by a window or something, or a low-lying wall, a lot of times in a first-person game now, you sort of have an option to pop up above the cover and sort of like use it as a place to rest your gun. Red Orchestra was one of the first games to do that, but it also goes a step further by like, you're basically able to brace your weapon against any surface you encounter. So, like, if you are standing next to a window, you don't have to crouch and use the windowsill. You can also just brace your gun, like, along the side of the wall. Things like that. So it gives you the sense that, like, you're inhabiting this space. And because the name of that game is entirely, like, dealing with the fussiness and clunkiness of each weapon, it actually ends up adding a lot to the game. I always really loved, like, anything that sort of evokes a sense of you are there, right? And maybe that's one of the reasons I reacted to this in Red Orchestra, but in one of the things I really loved about the F1 games that Codemasters put out is that a lot of racing games, you just, like, go from the menu and you materialize on the track in a car. And you don't really have the sense of, like, you being in any kind of physical space. You're just, like, you're a creature that exists within a car, or you exist in the menus. Something I really dug about the F1 series is that every session starts with you in the garage, basically. And you're in the car, but, like, you can see your mechanics going around, working on the car, tweaking settings. Like, if you say, like, oh, put the wet weather tires on the car, it doesn't just happen. Like, the crew comes around the car, and you can look around, and you'll see them, like, changing settings on the car in response to what you're doing. And that's, like, just little things like that, but it is a huge difference psychologically. It makes it feel a little bit less like, this is a game where you are a car, and a little more of, like, this is a game where I'm the driver of a car.
That stuff is amazing. I'll be really quick, because I know we gotta move on to other stuff in life. I'll do three things. I love the sound effects when you find a Korok in Zelda. There's, like, this really adorable little sort of woodsy sound effect. It's very Wind Waker-esque for the sort of Forbidden Woods area. And two animations that really stood out to me in games that I really, really loved and really enjoyed. In Rise of the Tomb Raider, every time, which is a great game, really, really good sort of video game-ass video game, outdoes Uncharted in a lot of ways, I think.
Yes, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, yes. All right. Good. Team Rise of the Tomb Raider here. Very nice. Whenever you get out of the water, Lara Croft actually sort of wrings out her hair, her ponytail, and it's like a very, like, it's a tiny detail, but it is one of those things that, like, just embodies you, like, right there, like, oh yeah, I'm, you know, ladies or people with long hair do that when they get out of water. It's like a very common kind of thing that was like, yeah, that actually kind of grounds the character in this sort of practical but sort of real way. And the other one being, in Firewatch, every time Henry descends, like, a staircase in his Firewatch tower, he kind of touches the upper beam. Like, he's just sort of ambling down, and he, like, touches that upper beam, and it's, like, a very cool little thing where it's, like, yeah, he's a tall guy. Like, he's in this space. He's really in this space. That's what, you know, Rob, you're a tall guy. I don't know if you personally
do that all the time.
All right,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, because if your hand's up there, you know where that is, and you're not going to clock yourself. Yeah.
You know, exactly. So I love stuff like that, too. I love exactly what you're saying about, like, things that put you there. You know, very much like, oh, yeah, I'm either there with the character, or this is telling me something about that character. I think that's super rad. And on that very happy note, I think it's time for us to say goodbye and get ready for our weekend, do all that kind of fun stuff. So, hey, Patrick, where can people find you on this great big internet?
You can find me at Patrick Klopik.
Awesome. Rob, how about you?
On Twitter.com, at Rob Zachney.
Oh, beautiful. You guys both have really good names for that. I guess mine's pretty close to that, too. I'm Danielle R.I. on Twitter. And you can always find us at Waypoint and at Waypoint Vice on Facebook. You can find all the amazing stuff that we do. Well, some of it's amazing. I like to think it's pretty amazing. We have a good website, right? You know, we make some good stuff on our website.
Vice, on Bazinga.
On Bazinga.zone. Yes, you can go to Bazinga.zone, new.donk.city. What are some of the other real good ones? I know there's like a... you know.
Anime.bad.
Anime.bad. Is that real?
No, I'm not sure. Nope. That's one of them.
Nope.
Someone should okay, make that mind. Happen.
Oh my god. Good. Good. Well, you can find all of those beautiful things not at anime.bad. And shout outs, of course, to our producer, Tim Barnes. Shout outs to Bowen, who lets us use his track, Miss You, off of the EP Pale Machine. You can go to waypoint.zone/Bowen. Thank you, everyone, for spending your time with us on Waypoint Radio. I will leave you with this. Be good, or be good at
it. And play Donkey Kong Country, Tropical Freeze, if the chance ever presents itself.
I mean, yeah.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.